The purpose of Frontline Fellowship, we all know, is to glorify God. But how do we glorify God? How are we best able to glorify God? That's a purpose, but it's not an easily measurable one. So what is our mission's primary way of fulfilling this goal of glorifying God? It's in our constitution, it's in our handbook, it's in our missionary handbook, office handbook. What's the main way that we focus on glorifying God? I think we've got a better way of putting it than that.
Literature, love.
Well, how about the Great Commission? Making disciples, teaching obedience to all things the Lord has commanded us. Because that kind of covers it all. Everything we do should be under the banner of glorifying God by making disciples of nations, teaching obedience to all things the Lord has commanded. The largest missions frontier, the most neglected, needy mission field in the world, is the Muslim Middle East, especially the 1040 window. 1040 window from North Africa through the Middle East, South Central Asia, going from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Between a 10th degree latitude in the Northern Hemisphere to the 40th degree latitude, the so-called 1040 window is missionary shorthand for the most neglected, needy mission fields in the world. In that 1040 window, you have over 4 billion non-Christians. And in that 1040 window, you've got most of the wars, most of the persecution of the church, the least amount of freedom, the greatest amount of suffering, and so on. Where the church has done the least amount of work, you've got the greatest amount of problems. Makes sense. Now, in the 1040 window, there is northern Nigeria, and there is, of course, the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. So that's our primary focus in the 1040 window, a bridgehead, a beachhead for impacting and influencing the Muslim Middle East. Fulfilling the Great Commission throughout the rest of the world, well, it's amazing what you can do through the World Wide Web, through mail, through email, through websites, sermon audio, through all the various platforms God's given us from Vimeo onwards. Of course, a subsidiary goal, how we glorify God and fulfill the Great Commission, is to smash Marxism, secular humanism, Marxism, particularly as it's imbibed itself into culture. Most people don't realize just how much communism has influenced every single area of life. For example, can you think of things that are accepted today by the average Christian, which Karl Marx innovated and was in the 1848 Marxist Manifesto? Examples.
State education.
Before 1848, before the Marxist Manifesto, education was understood to be a task of the church and the parents. States were not interested in education. States were, in fact, suspicious of education because governments don't want well-educated, well-read, critically thinking populations. It's against their interests. So the average government actually was hostile to apathetic. Apathetic if they were a fairly decent government, hostile if they were an evil government. And so Christians have dominated education through the millenniums. It's only in the last century that Christians have come to accept the basic Marxist premise that the state should train the teachers, license the teachers, produce the textbooks, and mandate compulsory education, compulsory attendance in state schools. And it's only in my lifetime that Christian, independent Christian schools, even mission schools, have thought that they've got to get accreditation from the state for education. I mean, this is a totally 100% Marxist idea. This is a Karl Marx, 1848 Marxist Manifesto idea that the state has anything to do with education. Education has always been entrusted to the parents and to the church. And it's been a parental and a church concern for millenniums. It is only literally in my lifetime that it has become accepted by the average unthinking Christian that the state has a legitimate concern and right over the education of our children. As though they care about your children more than you do. You know, chuckle, chuckle. They don't even care about their own children. So that's Marxism. Here's another one on Marxism. Well, anyone want to give some other suggestions on Marxist ideas we've accepted? Yeah, Ministry of Youth and Culture,
yeah.
Minister of Sports, Where does that come from? Find a biblical foundation for that. Why do we need a minister of anything aside from justice, defense, law and order? I mean, those would be about the only reasonable things. They have the sword of justice, they're to be a minister of justice, they're to punish those who do evil, they're to protect the law-abiding. And so you understand the state has the sword of justice, and therefore they should have an army, they should have police, although police should actually be run by the local municipalities, the local communities. They can have courts and so on, although again those can be very much down to the regional and provincial and municipal, it doesn't have to be a national thing. So there's no place in the Bible for the state to run the economy, to run the currency, to run health, to run education, or any of these matters. So cultural Marxism has so seeped through the church that you can see immediately if a person has been brainwashed by Marxism. His response to the average problem is, the government must. There ought to be a law. That's Marxist thinking. Karl Marx came up with the idea of progressive taxation to basically redistribute wealth by taxing at a higher percentage the most productive people, and thereby, if you think of it this way, a fine is a tax for doing something wrong, but a tax is a fine for doing something right. And so, as Ronald Reagan summarized it so well at the first time I heard him in America, National Religious Broadcasting Convention, January 1988, the government's philosophy is, if it works, tax it. If it doesn't work, subsidize it. And that's, in fact, why you get so many things that don't work and so many people who don't work, because the government subsidizes whatever doesn't work. And you get less people working and innovating and really being innovative because they get punished, taxed, confiscated if they actually do things right. So people learn very quickly to not actually earn that much because they're going to actually just have it taken away from them by a confiscatory tax. Here's another one, death taxes. Now, people who die and are leaving inheritance for their children, their children's children, that's what the Bible says you should do. But the government comes and wants to scoop up most, if not all of it, and certainly most of it if they can, in taxes. And so you've got to get very innovative to make sure the state doesn't steal what grandpa's already paid his taxes on, and he wants to give to his children and grandchildren, but now it's effectively looted. So death taxes, well, in fact, virtually all taxes. The Americans went to war with the British over 4% tax. No taxation without representation, was said. Now they get over 40% tax, and they seem to, and they sing about how free they are. You think of how in South Africa we are paying more taxes to the government for every litre of petrol than we are actually to the petrol company or the station combined. So literally most of what we pay at the petrol pump is tax and levies and everything else I want to call. But when you put it together, automobile associations proved that in fact well over 60-something percent of what we pay at the petrol pump is actually taxed to the government. And you can be sure it's looted, obviously, and total looting of everything from Eskom, Telkom, every state, everything, South African Airways and so on. This is Marxism. An average Christian think it's your duty to subsidize these whoremongering, blaspheming, Christ-hating, baby-killing Marxists in government, and that you must give them all that they deserve. You should hear a expose of Romans 13 also Render Unto Caesar What Is Caesar's by Richard Wurmbrand. Richard Wurmbrand, who suffered 14 years in concentration camps, said, give to Caesar what Caesar deserves. Well, he deserves a kick in the pants, and he deserves revolt, and he deserves to be overthrown, and he deserves to be kicked out, because Caesar is murdering God's people, oppressing God's people, brainwashing children to be blasphemers and idolaters. And, well, Richard Wurmbrand expands on it dramatically, because he knew what Marxism was. Ceausescu, render unto Ceausescu the things that are Ceausescu's. What does he deserve? Well, to be put against a wall and shot, actually, is what they did in the end, on Christmas Day 1989, because Ceausescu was a brute, and he is murdering and oppressing God's people, banning Bibles. And Richard Wurmbrand, with a touch of theatrical, brought up the very prison where he had been tortured, brought up the very printing presses that the Securitate, the secret police, were using, and printed Bibles off those printing presses in the very cells where they were tortured, on the Avenue of the Victory of Socialism. I mean, how's that for irony and justice and so on? But for us to see the need to smash Marxism in people's minds, in 2 Corinthians 10, we read about how we must take every thought captive and make it obey Christ, to pull down every stronghold raised against the knowledge of Christ. Everything that is up there, raising up obstacles to people coming to Christ, needs to be pulled down. That's atheism, it's evolutionism, it's secular humanism, it's Marxism, which is super pervasive. And I've just been seeing a research yesterday being done on how Reformed colleges have been infiltrated for decades to turn them into Marxists. And there's a surprising new development in America that in recent years there's been a colossal amount of what they call social justice warriors, SJWs. We may not have heard that yet, but it's very popular in America. And these social justice warriors, you trace it all goes back to Marxists who've deliberately targeted Reformed colleges to turn these people into cultural Marxists. And obviously it's Marxism without the atheism, but it's still cultural Marxism. Just as at the first Comintern, Stalin, Communist International, Stalin identified Hollywood and the theological seminaries of the West as the most important, highest priorities for communist infiltrate, and they did. And they managed to get Harvard, Princeton, all these great theological colleges, which had been founded as Christian colleges, turn them into Marxist centers of learning. And, of course, they hijacked Hollywood. In fact, as was well said, the Communist Party was the only party in town in Hollywood. No other political party had thought of infiltrating Hollywood. They got it from the beginning. And they made sure that the movies, as I said, we're going to make the cinemas the churches of Marxism in the West. There's a lot of cultural Marxism in people's minds. If somebody thinks the government should, and there ought to be a law, and that the solution to every problem is a new law, a new government department, a new tax, which is what you get from the ACDP and virtually every other Christian party out there. We need more taxes, we need more of this, and the government must spend more of this, and we need more billions in education. No, we don't. That's the wrong way, completely. But it shows how much Marxism has infiltrated people's way of thinking. And the amount of Christians who think that idolatry like this, well, in our country we've got Mandela, in America they've got Lincoln, here's Fidel Castro standing in idolizing of his idol, Abraham Lincoln, who was about as Marxist as they come. And it's telling that you can go to Cuba and see in Havana Avenue of Abraham Lincoln and the Abraham Lincoln High School and all that sort of thing, because Abraham Lincoln was a Marxist and his party was built up by Marxists, and that's why the Republican Party to this day has got red ties and the Democrats have got blue ties. They might have changed their positions over the years, but originally the Republican Party were the red Republicans and they were all made up of 48ers, and the 48ers were revolutionaries from Europe who had taken part in 1848 revolutions. But again, people don't always follow this. Just like you have these Christians, how many people have been telling us about their schools where Christian teachers and Christian schools have been teaching their children about Mandela Day and what a wonderful man he is. And you speak to these people and they're often aware that, yes, well, we know that Mandela legalized abortion and, yes, pornography and, yes, blasphemy and, yes, Sabbath desecration. But, I mean, look at a wonderful person he was. That kind of brainwashing is pretty bad. And so we know where the solid rock is. But the Church of Christ has been moving out off the solid rock onto compromise, complacency, and tolerance. In fact, tolerance, many people would swear it's in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not be intolerant, because it's treated as the most important of the Ten Commandments. We've gone off into left field. An average church is not based on the scriptures and the Great Commission. It's mostly based on the culture of today. Why? Well, if we watch SATV, and if we watch ETV, if we read the newspapers of the world, and if we imbibe the world's textbooks, and if our children are educated in the state schools, and we read the state textbooks, well, it doesn't matter how nice your heart is, your brain and your values are going to move more and more onto those issues that the state thinks is most important. And you can be sure they're not bringing up the real issues of today. Just as one example, they will damn the slavery of 200 years ago, which was ended by Wilberforce and other Christians, but they won't damn the slavery going on right now today. 160 countries in the world are involved in human trafficking. Member states of the UN, the UN themselves, the Secretary General himself, as documented in the whistleblower. So when we talk about bringing people back to the Bible, that's why it's so important to use the Reformation 500 to get people inspired about these great momentous milestones, which would hopefully inspire people to get back to the Bible and see, well, what in our culture needs reforming. Now, Martin Luther looked in the Bible and he said, I don't read about the Pope in the Bible. In fact, I don't read about cardinals and archbishops in the Bible either. In fact, where's purgatory in the Bible? And the Mass? Where is the Mass in the Bible? And he went through so many things. And how do you buy salvation? Where's indulgences in the Bible? So he saw so much of what was important in the churches around him, not in the scriptures. And so he made a stand, and we cheer and say, good for you. But okay, let's look at our churches. Where in the Bible do we get age-segregated services? Where do we get teen church? Where do we get youth leaders? And you could just carry on with a whole lot of strange things we do religiously, like it's super important. We don't have a biblical foundation for it, but this is the way it's always been done. And when Martin Luther came up with his five solas and his 95 theses, a lot of people criticizing him, saying, you're attacking established church practice. Indulgences and pilgrimages and adoring relics and buying time off purgatory and being baptized for the dead and cardinals. I mean, this has got centuries of tradition behind it. How can you attack established traditions of the church? But you're saying scripture alone is the ultimate authority. Christ alone is the head of the church. No pope can be head of the church, and so on. Well, do we have people with the courage to look at what's going on in our churches and saying, is this even biblical? Where in the Bible do you read about the people of God sending their children off to the Philistines and the Hittites to be educated? It's just unthinkable. It's incomprehensible. And yet you've got Bible-believing Christians who love the Lord, who honestly think they're doing a good thing by sending their children and paying for their children to be brainwashed by whoremongering, blaspheming perverts who hate Christ, and bringing it into our homes and bringing it into our churches. I have come across churches where, I've, as a guest speaker, I've been to many a church, and so I remember being at a church where they whisked my children off to the children's church, and well, you know, we don't normally do it, but I didn't think it would be that bad. I mean, this is a Bible-believing church. Suddenly I see Christopher come walking out. And, I mean, I'm preaching now. So I had to find out later why. And then I see Daniela come out as well. I thought, that's interesting. I found out later, well, Christopher walked out because they were showing a Barney video. And he said, that's not a Sunday video. And Barney's a humanist. And he might have been small, but he knew Barney. Because Andrea had asked me, why does Barney never talk about Jesus? And I said, because Barney's a humanist. You know, he never mentioned Jesus because Barney's the secular humanist. And what's humanism explained all that? My children could say it off pat. And so when a Sunday school teacher started showing a Barney video, he said, he got up and walked out, came and joined us service. And Daniela walked out because saw that the Sunday school teacher was wearing a fur coat. And she said, it takes 40 dumb animals to make a fur coat, but only one to wear it. And she said, no, I don't support fur. Walked out of the Sunday school as well. And I thought, well, that's the way I've raised them. That's a good thing. This is they're thinking for themselves. Outstanding. And my daughter Andrea was the first to create chaos in our church by refusing to join teen church. When she turned 13, she stayed seated in a service when all the teens had to go out for teen church before the sermon, because you can't expect teenagers to have the brains to understand a sermon. They've got to go off and have some extrovert making a fool of themselves, that's meant to be what they do for Sunday services during the sermon. And she wouldn't do it, and that created a crisis. Next thing, other teens were staying in the service, and before you knew it, almost all the teens were staying in the service and not going out, and the youth pastor was complaining he doesn't have his youth congregation, and, well, it wasn't biblical. But this is the point. We may say, well, you know, this is different. Well, yes, this is in our generation, but every generation needs to say, is what we're doing biblical? Is it healthy? State schools are disastrous, catastrophic. Youth groups are catastrophic. It's been proven by every study that youth groups chase the youth out of the church. when the youth reach the end of their age and are no longer young enough to be in a youth group, they don't move into adult part church. They move away. And so the youth groups, which are meant to keep the youth in church, they actually do the opposite. And they're not integrating the church. It's not their church. And so when they're no longer able to go to youth, they just drift off. It's a catastrophe. We've never had such a destruction of our churches. And I'd say everything that's been done in our churches, including throwing out thousands of years of church history and hymns and all the heritage of the church and the church liturgies and everything else, it's catastrophic. It's like we've removed ourselves off the moorings. So that's why the whole theme is back to the Bible for reformation and revival. In the Bible, you've got the blueprints for life on everything. Education, economics, crime, punishment, justice, everything. Structures for government. Now, some of the building blocks we've used is getting our Ten Commandments books out. This is pretty basic, but you've got to start somewhere. Going through every book in the Bible. The one thing that struck me so much going through each book in the Bible is just how little present church practice in the 21st century church has to do with the Bible. Virtually anything you can think of that's going on, what the church is obsessed with, is not a biblical concern. And it can go from one side to the other. Back in 2014, I was ministering in England and had the opportunity to visit Glastonbury. Now, Glastonbury was the greatest church in all of England from the 4th century. This dates back literally, in fact, they date back to the 1st century, the original churches there. And it is said by the people in Somerset, that's southwestern England, the furthest edge you can get in England, way out to the west into the Atlantic Ocean. And they say, because I was shown the graves of Mary, that's the Mother Mary, and Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and they built churches and tombs. Well, something must have happened there. Joseph Arimathea is meant to be buried there too. He had tin mines in the area. Well, something seriously happened there, because for centuries, for over a millennium, this was the prime pilgrimage spot in all of England for Middle Ages Christians to visit. But when you look here, what's the thing that strikes you? Ruins. And honestly, our churches can look like this. In fact, they may not look this good 1,500 years from now if we're not careful. Every single generation has to have a revival and has to make it their faith. Because, honestly, Crisis of Intermission could look like this in one generation if the next generation doesn't take the baton, get serious, get back the Bible. You can't depend on the generation that founded it. I've gone around the world and I've been in churches such as Saint-Pierre, where John Calvin preached, or in the Schlosskirche, where Martin Luther preached, or to Grossmünster, where Ulrich Zwingli preached. And most of those churches don't have the gospel being preached in them anymore. Many of them are nicely preserved, though. The buildings are. But what's preached on the inside isn't. But others are ruins. And this should just remind us, what makes us think that our churches or missions are going to be standing and operating 100, 200, 300 years from now? Well, in some cases, not even a generation later. 2 years after James Kennedy died, his church, Coleridge Presbyterian Church, was already hijacked by someone who despised everything he stood for. Tullian Trevelyan, grandson of Billy Graham, managed to convince the elders to hand over the greatest Presbyterian church in the world, a church with 12,000 members. James Kennedy had built it into probably the richest piece of real estate in the Western world for Christianity. It had Coleridge Ministries, publishing center, radiant TV program, watched by 12 million people a week. His books printed in the millions. Knox Theological Seminary across the road. Tremendous. Knox Theological Seminary had founders like James Kennedy, R.C. Sproul, E. Calvin Beisner. Within 2 days of James Kennedy being buried, they kicked out R.C. Sproul and E. Calvin Beisner. And within a week after he died, they brought an atheistic evolutionist onto the faculty. Today, Knox Theological Seminary has been demolished and it's a parking lot. sold up by Italian civilian to pay for the church building, which now was rattling around. He managed to take down a 12,000 congregation to 800 and then to 200 in the space of a few years. How did he do this? Well, he managed to bring a keyboard and drums in front of the greatest pipe organ in North America with 2,800 organs, pipes and organ, and they had a keyboard and drums there. Chased away the choir, chased away the greatest orchestra they had in North America. In fact, I've attended things like Matthew's Passion, where they had 8 times more people in the symphony orchestra in James Kennedy's congregation, Corus Presbyterian Church, than we had in our Cape Town City Hall at the height, back before City Council stripped it down to its barest. They had the best of everything. The church had to have 5 services on Sunday. Italian Chavillian brought it down to 1 service a Sunday. They used to have 20 services a week at the church. He brought it down to 1 a week. And so he had to sell up the buildings all around and everything else to be able to sustain this. While the entire congregation of Coleridge Presbyterian Church moved down the road and were meeting in a rented school hall, wearing their gowns, processionals, recessionals, carrying the cross, and because they're traditional high Presbyterians. And here's this gelled, spiked head, open-necked shirt, emergent, sitting on a stool next to this pulpit of James Kennedy's, dialoguing with the people, with the keyboard and the drums behind by some hippies. And of course, it's a traditional church with traditional worship. It chased out the members. He offended the daughter of James Kennedy and wife of James Kennedy, his widow, by preaching against door-to-door evangelism, saying the date for door-to-door evangelism. Now, that's what James Kennedy built his entire ministry on, was door-to-door evangelism. He never accepted an invitation for Thursday night. Every Thursday night, he was knocking on doors, doing EE and going into the highways and byways and knocking on doors to go in and sit down with people and share the gospel with them. And here this little spiked punk thinks that he can come in and criticize the founder in his, well, not in his pulpit, but next to his pulpit, because he disdained pulpits, and turned this church from a 12,000-member church down to a 200-member church in a matter of just a few years. Bankrupted it. Oh, an Italian civilian then fell into sin, blamed his wife, divorced her, out of the ministry. Now he's back in the ministry, angry at everybody. It's everyone's fault, actually. His wife's fault, everyone's. It's not his fault, of course. This is the thing about these new social justice warriors. Nothing's their fault. They're victims. Now, that's one church. Now, to think that it took centuries for churches of Luther and Calvin to be hijacked by people who didn't share the gospel. But it took 2 years for James Kennedy's church to be hijacked, just showing how you can have... Now, those elders of that church are culpable. I asked James Kennedy once, what's your succession plan? He said, I'm a Presbyterian. I'm not allowed to have a succession plan. The elders rule in a Presbyterian church. It's not his call. He said, however, I do have a succession plan for evangelism explosion. I mean, that's his ministry, but the congregation, he's just the pastor. So he doesn't have a succession plan. Well, he built it up, and others are dismantling it. And this is what goes on all over the world. All over the world. I mean, I've seen what happened to Summit Ministries after the founder, David Noble, retired. Seen what happened to Bill Bethlen. Bill Bethlen's In Touch Mission kicked out the founder. World Vision kicked out the founder. The man who founded World Vision, it was a hijacking. And he then went down the road and started a new ministry called Samaritan's Purse and recruited Franklin Graham to take that over as his succession. So Samaritan's Purse today is a very effective ministry, but it was founded by Bob Pierce, the man who founded World Vision, who was stabbed in the back by his board, who kicked him out, hijacked it, and then took it from an evangelical, soul-winning organization to a worldly... You meet a World Vision person in the field now, you wouldn't even know he's a Christian. In fact, I remember when I went to Sudan the first time, and I mentioned World Vision, and the people were convinced they were all pagans. I was shocked. Well, discovered later they are. In fact, the World Vision people in the field I've met one of them who knows the Lord. So World Vision was an outstanding example of an evangelical, soul-winning ministry. What Samaritan's Purse is now, but that's what it was. It got hijacked. There are so many examples of this. There's treachery, there's infiltration, there's backstabbing, there's sabotage throughout the Christian world, and we shouldn't be surprised. It's been a high priority for the Marxists from the beginning, right from the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution, to infiltrate seminaries, to infiltrate missions, to infiltrate churches, and they've managed to infiltrate some of the biggest Reformed theological seminaries in America and destroy them from the inside. And that's just coming out right now, how they've managed to turn the bastions of Bible-believing conservatism into liberation theology, social justice warriors who are interested in everything except the gospel. So these wrecks, these ruins here, are just a good example of what can happen to any church, any ministry, any Bible college, any theological seminary if we're not careful. Without a back-to-the-Bible reformation and revival in every generation, any ministry is basically a generation away from extinction. It can happen, and that's why it's got to be everybody is taking evangelism seriously.